or yesterday rather, we had yet another double parsha, the parshias of Acharei Mos and Kedoshim. For those of you who study the halachos of Haftoras, this is actually the most complicated question, halachically, of what Haftorah do you read, and the reason is the following. If you look in a standard Chumash, the Haftorah of Acharei Mos is from Amos, and the Haftorah of Kedoshim is from Yechezkel, which talks about the deprivations of Yerushalayim. However, when they are mechubar, the normal rule is when two parshiyos are mechubar, you always read the Haftorah of the last one, which would indicate that you would read the Haftorah of Kedoshim. But the one exception is Acharei Mos and Kedoshim, where when they are mechubar, you read the Haftorah of Acharei Mos, which is why you heard that. Now, there's another machlokas. Even when they're separated, do you reverse the order? So there are two separate questions that some say Amos is read after Kedoshim, and some say Yechezkel is read after Acharei Mos. So you have two separate machlokasim. One is, what do you do when they're together? The other is, what do you do when they're separated? So if you got confused, or if you saw a chumash with five or six different directions, that is because indeed there's a great amount of halachic uncertainty. But since we did read the Haftorah of Acharei Mos, and the Haftorah does have a certain theme connected to Acharei Mos, I want to share that with you. Acharei Mos, of course, deals almost, 75% of Acharei Mos is the service of the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur, going into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and the service is given in great detail. And in fact, that is the foundation, that is number one, the Torah reading on Yom Kippur, and number two, it is the foundation of the Musaf, davening on Yom Kippur, which goes through what's called the Seder Avoda in a great amount of detail. But what's interesting is that when the Torah gives you the Seder Avoda, the Torah is makdim. It makes the point that this is being given after the deaths of Aaron's children. Now, of course, chronologically that's true, but why would the Torah emphasize it unless there is some kind of thematic connection between the tragedy of the death of Nadab and Avihu and the imperatives that are connected to the Yom Kippur service? Otherwise, it's just a question of chronology. The Torah doesn't have to repeat every event that preceded the commandment that it's giving. So I want to explore that a little bit, and then we'll see in the Haftorah that indeed there is a connection there. First, what was the sin? Nadab and Avihu, this is the day the Mishkan was dedicated, Rosh Chodesh Nisan, a day of great joy, a great of great simcha, a day that the Gemara describes is as great a joy as the Shemayim, as the creation of Shemayim Va'aretz. And yet on that day, Aaron loses his two oldest children, Nadav and Avihu, and the Torah says that Nadav and Avihu died because they brought an Eish Zara, a foreign fire, to God, Asher Lo Tzuva Osam, for which they were not commanded. And Pshuto Shel Mikra is that they were bringing Ketores, and Ketores has to be taken from, well, the incense is burnt from coals that are taken from the altar. And on the day of Chanukah Sabayis, the altar was ignited by a fire that came from Shemayim, but instead they brought their own matches, they brought their own coals, this was a foreign fire, they brought in a fire that God did not want, and as a result, midah keneged midah, a fire of God entered them. And the Gemara even describes that the deaths of Nadav and Avihu is sreifas neshama v'guf kayim. That means to say that the body was intact, the body was not mutilated, it was like a fire entered their nostrils and burnt their neshama, but the guf itself was pure. So the Chumash itself tells us what is the Aveira of Nadav and Avihu. It was a technical offense that they brought in Eish Zara instead of using the Eish that came down min HaShemayim. And yet, Chazal, and Rashi brings some of it, Chazal go to great lengths to talk about what the sin of Nadav and Avihu was, and they come up with every possible sin except the one that the Chumash says. Let's catalog. We can come up with six or seven Averos that Chazal identify. The first one that Chazal identify, which Rashi brings, is they entered the Mishkan, they entered the tabernacle, Shesuya Yayin, they drank wine, they were drunk, although halachically, even if you drink a revias of wine, you can't go in. And Rashi's proof, or the Midrash's proof, is that right after the death of Nadav and Avihu, God commands, be sure when you enter the Mishkan not to drink wine. Now, if you think about this, there's actually a logical problem with that type of reasoning. Those of you that are from the United States and may remember your civics classes or your constitutional law classes may know that the Constitution of the United States prohibits the enactment of what is called an ex post facto law. An ex post facto law simply means a law that punishes behavior that was legal at the time you did it. Now, to say that Nadav and Avihu died because they drank wine when the prohibition against drinking wine was given after they died is a problem of an ex post facto law, but we'll talk about that. But that's Avera number one that Rashi says, Shasui Yayin. Avera number two, the Medrash tells us, they didn't get married. And because they didn't get married, that was an Avera. They were taken from the world. Well, it's hard to know, because we know that Aaron himself, their father, was 86 years old at the time. So it's hard to know how old they were. You know, we don't know how old Aaron was when he gave birth to them. The third Aveira is they used to be Morei Halacha Bifnei Rabam. That when Moshe and Aaron would be asked Shilas, and of course Moshe would be the posek, Nadav and Avihu would interject. They would paskin in the presence of Moshe and Aaron, which was not kavodik. To this very day, you're not allowed. A person is not allowed to paskin in the presence of his Rebbe or even in the city of his Rebbe. In fact, you should know that what is called smicha, rabbinical ordination, is not real smicha. I hate to say it, we're all a bunch of fakers. Maybe you thought that anyway. But basically, all rabbis are not authentic in the sense that real smicha requires unbroken ordination from Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's why we don't have a Sanhedrin, although someone's trying to do it, but we don't have a Sanhedrin because that requires smicha. And smicha can only exist when Eliyahu HaNavi comes back. He has the unbroken line. He can restore it. So what is smicha, technically? Well, smicha is a kind of a diploma of proficiency. But technically, smicha is the permission your Rebbe gives you to paskin halacha. Because otherwise, you would not be allowed to paskin halacha if your Rebbe is available. Right? So smicha is technically, in fact, that's why the more accurate term for modern-day smicha is netilas rishus, getting permission, or heter hora, again, which means permission to paskin different shilas. Okay, now, so they committed the sin, right? This is our third sin. So the first sin, well, eish zara is what the Chumash says. We'll have to come back to that. The next aveira is drinking wine. The next aveira is not getting married. The next aveira is mora halacha bifnei rabbah. The next Aveira, which is somewhat similar, is that they were waiting. They were saying to themselves, Masai Yamusu Sekenim Halalu. When will these old folk die so we can take over the leadership? That may explain why they were Mora Halacha Bifnei Rabba. Yet another Aveira, and we'll tie all these together, hopefully. Yeah. The other Aveira was that they entered the Mishkan, or the courtyard of the Mishkan, not wearing all of the requisite big day kahuna. This is a very important rule. The avoda of the Beis HaMikdash or the Mishkan is not kosher unless the Kohen is wearing exactly what he's supposed to wear. By the way, even an extra garment is no good, which is very interesting. If it's a very cold day and the Kohen is working outside bringing korbanos and he puts on a sweater or a scarf, the whole avoda is puzzle. Wear socks? Puzzle. Gloves? Puzzle. That's called merubah begadim. You're wearing too many begadim. But with Nadav and Avihu, the chisaron was, the Medrash tells us, they were mechusar begadim. We'll see what the significance of that is. And then there are two final ones I'll mention. And the one of them is that really Nadav and Avihu were chayav misa from the time of Matan Torah. If you remember, there was a vision at the time of Matan Torah of the heavenly throne of Hashem, v'tachas raglav, and under the legs of the Shechina kavyachol, was Maisa Livnas HaSapir, there was the sapphire throne of the Kisei HaKavod, and it says that the youngsters of Yisrael, Vayechasu Esa Elokim, literally, they gazed at Hashem, Vayechlu Vayishtu, and they ate and they drank. Now, whether you understand this to mean Kalis Reish, that they're eating and drinking while they're gazing at the Shekhinah, or whether you understand it like the Rambam, that it's soul food, that their neshama were absorbing the holiness of the divine presence. That's how the Rambam understands it. But the Medrash tells us they were chayav misa, based on the verse, Lo yirani ha'adam v'chay. You cannot look at God, whatever that means, and live. They were chayav misa. And yet, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not want to take away from the joy of Matan Torah. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu deferred their death to the Chanukah Samishkan, which is interesting. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you see from here that L'chara Matan Torah is a greater simcha than the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu had no problem, so to speak, with killing them on the day of that. Let me just mention the final Aveira, and then I'll address for a side point. The final Aveira, the Medrash tells us, is that it really wasn't their chait, it was Aaron's chait. Because of the chait to Egel, Aaron deserved to lose all of his four sons. And Moshe Rabbeinu's tefillah annulled the decree on half, and therefore he lost two because of the chait ha'egel. So I'm losing count here. But if we... Okay, so the Torah itself says Eish Zara, and Chazal tell us drinking wine, not getting married, Mora Halacha Bifnei Rabba, waiting for Moshe and Aaron to die, not wearing the begadim, that's five additional ones. Then we have the Vayechazu, the Kalus Reish of gazing at the Shechina by Matan Torah, and the punishment of Aaron because of the Chet HaEgel. Chazal give us seven Averos. The one Avera they don't give us is the Avera the Chumash says. And the question becomes, how can Chazal say they did all of these Averos if the Chumash says the Avera was Eish Zara? Now, let me just digress for a second to go totally off topic, just to share with you another little ha'ara in terms of chronology. And that is, it's interesting that what day did Nadav and Avihu die? We know that Nadav and Avihu died the day the Mishkan was dedicated, that's for sure. What day was the Mishkan dedicated? So there's actually a machlokas. The majority opinion of Chazal, which is followed by Rashi, is that the Mishkan was dedicated Rosh Chodesh Nisan, following 7 days of preparation, which began the 23rd of Adar. The Ibn Ezra, however, changes the whole chronology, and he actually says the 7 days of preparation began Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and the dedication of the Mishkan was the 8th of Nisan, and Nadav and Avihu died the 8th of Nisan, not the 1st of Nisan. He brings a fascinating proof. And the fascinating proof actually comes up from a Yom Tov that we're going to, or at least a festive day that we're going to celebrate very soon, and that's Pesach Sheni. On the 14th of Iyar, people came to Moshe Rabbeinu and they said, or before that then, says, we were Tamei, we were not able to bring the Korban Pesach, don't we get a second chance? And Moshe Rabbeinu asks HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, if people are Tamei or Bederech Rechoka, they have a chance to bring the Korban Pesach a month later. Now the question is, why were these people Tamei? So according to at least one opinion in the Gemara, they were Tamei because these were the Levim who buried the bodies of Nadav and Avihu. Now, says the Ibn Ezra the following point. When a person gets Tamei with a mace, they're only Tamei for 7 days. So if they became Tamei on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, by the 14th of Nisan, they could bring a Korban Pesach. Masha'ein Kain, if they became Tamei on the 8th of Nisan, then Erev Pesach on the 14th, they're still going to be tame until sunset. And although after sunset they'd be able to eat the Korban Pesach, but you have to, at the time of Shechita, you have to be tahar. And therefore the Eben Ezra says, at least according to that opinion, it's mukhrach that they died on the 8th of Nisan and not on the 1st. Rashi would have to answer that he is following the other opinion in the Gemara that says that the people who were Tameh were the people who were carrying the bones of Yosef. So that would be any day of the year. There was a rotation, so anyone who carried those bones would be Tameh, and therefore Nadav and Avihu died earlier. The Leviim that buried Nadav and Avihu were not Tameh, but somebody else was Tameh who were carrying Arono Shel Yosef. Yeah. I didn't hear you.
Couldn't
what?
They have a personal.
Well, that's possible. That is, of course, that would be the simplest answer. The Ramban actually says, though, I don't know if Rashi would agree with this, that there were no natural deaths in the desert other than those recorded. He says nobody died in the Midbar except for those that are recorded as dying. The Meraglim, of course, that was a whole generation, but that was later. There was no Misa. By the way, Pesach Sheni is a tremendous Musar because the Chiddushi Arim points out that Hashem gave them the second chance only because they asked him for it. What would have been if a person's attitude is, hey, I don't have to bring the Korban Pesach, I'm Tomei, I'm Potter, I was doing a mitzvah. There wouldn't have been Pesach Sheni. Meaning, the lesson of Pesach Sheni is a profound lesson. HaKadosh Baruch Hu always gives you another chance. But you have to want it enough to ask. If you don't ask, it doesn't happen. Pesach Sheni came into the world only because people cared so much about serving Hashem that they begged. I mean, imagine, although it's not exactly the same, imagine if before Pesach you got a signed, sealed, a stamped document from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that you don't have to clean for Pesach this year. And let's assume it was really authentic. You really knew it was authentic.
Yeah.
You know, how many, like maybe I'll just talk about myself, I don't want to say, would say, no, give me a chance, I want to do it.
Yeah.
Most of us, perhaps, well, I shouldn't say most, but people, a lot of people might say, you know, Baruch Hashem, if I'm Potter, I'm Potter.
Yeah.
Well, they were, of course, bringing the Korban Pesach is not so much tikh, I understand. I understand it's not a great analogy, but okay. But the point is, if you're Potter, you're Potter. You don't have to ask Hashem, give me a chance. But if you love Hashem, even when you're Pacher, you say, please, please, let me have this opportunity. And the lesson of Pesach Sheni is Hashem gives you the opportunity. But anyway, I just brought this in as a little digression, that contrary to Rashi, the Eben Ezra brings a proof from Pesach Sheni that Nadav and Avihu died on the 8th of Nisan. Okay. But be it as it may, the main question I want to discuss is, what's this business of finding seven other Averos if the Torah itself says the Avera was Eishara? So the answer must be that Chazal are not adding to the list, but all of these seven Averos are explaining, Al Pidrush, what does it mean to have Eishara? They are variations on what is Eishara. And here is the way it works. Eish, fire, is often symbolic of passion and love and enthusiasm and zeal. Shir HaShirim, which of course is the great mashal for the love that Hashem has for the Jewish people and the Jewish people have for Hashem, uses the metaphor at the end in Perek Ches, Mayim Rabim Lo Yuchlu Lachabos Esahava, the greatest amount of water cannot extinguish the fire of love. And as Rashi points out, that means no matter how much the Umos HaOlam try to destroy us and drown us and take away our connection to Hashem, there will be a fire, at least in some Jews, that will always burn. Right? So Eish is a symbol of passion, of love, of enthusiasm. So that's a great thing. Eish is a wonderful quality. Zara, however, means it's a quality which is foreign in the sense that it's not contained within the boundaries that HaKadosh Baruch Hu enacted. And here is the dilemma that a spiritual person has. The nature, in fact, this was really part of why the Vilna Gaon had opposition to Hasidus, part of the reason. The nature of a spiritual person is that they are often impatient with the minutiae of detail. For example, let's just say Zaman Kriya Shema is whatever it is, 8:46. Where you have to eat the afikomen by chatzos.
Yeah.
And a person is involved in Devekus and Psukei Dezimra. He's pouring out his heart and his soul to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And somebody taps him in the shoulder and says, gotta say Shema in the next 2 minutes. He says, what are you doing? You're taking me away from my connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So often, one of the occupational hazards, halvai we should be on that madrega, but often one of the occupational hazards of a deeply spiritual person is they find it difficult to live within boundaries and constraints and rules and regulations. They break through. In fact, Rav Kook actually has poetry. Rav writes about the idea of don't contain. Rav Kook, who was a great, great halachic gadol. Rav Kook was a tremendous gadol in halacha. But sometimes he talked about the fact he didn't want to be confined in boxes, in ropes. He wanted to experience Hashem without all of the limitations that exist in the world. Or a person's having a Pesach Seder, a person is experiencing the inner liberation of the soul from slavery. And somebody says, gotta have Afikomen now.
Yeah.
So this is a conflict that exists because the spiritual temperament has a certain, to use a fancy word, antinomian quality about it. Antinomian just means against law. In other words, the spiritual temperament might rebel against the formalism of rule. Le'idach gisa, on the other side of the coin, you sometimes find that people who are very, very medactic about rules follow the rule without thinking about the ultimate connection to Hashem. This is an old Hasidic joke. You know, one of the halachic criticisms of the Hasidic movement, which to some degree still exists today, is that they daven mincha after sunset, after shkia. And halacha is pretty clear. You're supposed to daven mincha before shkia. Again, I'm not going to get into the defense of different customs. Obviously, Gedolim have different ways of looking at things. But the old Hasidic joke is, a litvak has more fear of the shkia than of the Ribbono Shel Olam, right? The litvak is worried about the sun. We're worried about serving Hashem. So these are stiras that exist between passion of wanting to be connected to Hashem, but the need to follow boundaries and constraints. Metaphorically, Eish Zara refers to a passionate desire to connect to God, but it's foreign because Asher Lo Tzuva, because it's not within the boundaries that God has given you. Meaning, it is the height of arrogance to say, I want a relationship to God without following God's own rules. Right? I want to express my love of God without doing what Hashem wants. I want to express my Yiras Hashem without doing what Hashem has commanded me. Right? This is the problem. So the dilemma, the problem of Nadav and Avihu, and the Netziv says this, is they were so consumed with love of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Their neshama was so davuk that they were not able to live within the boundaries that Hashem gave them. And in many ways, their neshama leaving is not always understood as a punishment. But literally, the neshama left the guf. Because mitzvos are how we connect to Hashem within the physical limitations of our bodies. We serve Hashem b'maisa ha-mitzvos. But their soul was so davuk in Hashem, those boundaries didn't apply to them and their soul just left. Now, if you look at it this way, then all seven averos are expressions of that Eisara. Drinking wine. Of course they didn't get drunk, that's not the issue. But the notion is, if your mindset is such that the most important thing in serving Hashem is the inner emotion of love and awe and reverence, then one can understand that alcohol, or even narcotics, right? A lot of religious cults actually use psychedelic mushrooms,
yeah,
LSD, whatever it would be. I think they just had plain wine. One could understand this as heightening one's awareness. And in fact, the fact that even in halacha we use wine for kiddush and for sheva brachos, we recognize the notion of yayin yisamach levav enosh. And in their logic, they thought it was totally appropriate in avodas beis hamikdash to use the stimulant. The problem is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, in the mikdash you don't do that. Once again, they didn't understand that boundary. But it was a desire to heighten their emotion at the expense of halachic detail. Not getting married is the same issue. Many religions, including classical Catholicism, believes that holiness, true holiness, requires celibacy. True holiness, meaning, as I believe Paul says in the Christian Bible, that God permitted marriage because since people have yetzer haras, better to marry than to burn by being promiscuous. But the ideal of holiness is separation. And they saw this earth, they saw Gashmius, they saw the relationship of man and wife, they saw the minutiae of running a household as a contradiction to their spiritual aspiration of Devekus. And therefore they didn't get married. Even though, and of course they had a role model. They had the role model, because Moshe Rabbeinu was married, Moshe Rabbeinu had children. It's not a complete role model, but Moshe Rabbeinu was also Poresh Meyishto. But once again, Moshe Rabbeinu is Moshe Rabbeinu. He is not the example. Moshe Rabbeinu is not to be emulated in that way.
But he separated from his wife.
He did, because Moshe Rabbeinu was a separate, unique category. But Moshe Rabbeinu is not, in that respect, he is not held up as a model that we emulate. But once again, it signifies the notion of a devekus, which is not rooted in the earthly needs and in the earthly commandments of not repudiating the physical and the material, but elevating it and sanctifying it. And similarly, the notion of paskening in front of Moshe symbolically is understood the same way. Moshe and Aaron represent what we call the halachic system. They paskened in front of Moshe, meaning to say they were trying to create an alternative reality where instead of halachic structure, one focuses on the cultivation of the inner spirits. Exactly as early Hasidus did, and Lahavdol, many, many Havdolas, various movements of spirituality within the Jewish world as well, often advocate connecting to God, but not necessarily by following the mitzvos of God. Creating alternative structures. Mara halacha b'fnei rabo. Similarly, when will these elders die? Meaning, who needs rules? We can cut our own private deal with Hashem. Begadim? Well, clothes are symbolic of that which differentiates me. In other words, clothes separate people. They didn't want separation. They wanted direct connection with God. So stripping away clothes symbolically is the notion of no mechitzas, no division, no boundaries. We want direct contact. Gazing at the Shekhinah, once again, and perhaps that's what put them in that matzah. They had perceived the Shekhinah in such an intimate way. And finally, the Chedo Ego of Aaron is a sin that is similar to that. Because why did the Jewish people build an ego? Because they wanted a visual, tangible connection to God that they could comprehend. They didn't want the distance. By the way, I once heard, indeed, from my own Rosh Hashiva of Yaakov Weinberg Zatzal, that part of the enormous emotional attraction of Christianity is that by making God, chas v'shalom, human, it gives us a way of connecting to him with an intimacy that we otherwise cannot have. Yes, by making God human, chas v'shalom, it allows us to connect to him with a sense of intimacy that we cannot have. Now the problem is, of course, it happens to be false. In other words, it's a lie, it's not true. But the attraction of it is, it's a lie that has a tremendous emotional power that one cannot deny. the notion of God is just like me. Now, of course, we do say, and David HaMelech says, Imo Anochi Bitzara, HaKadosh Baruch Hu experiences our tzaras, HaKadosh Baruch Hu suffers with us, HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves us, but it's not understood in the same way, meaning to say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not have, you know, emotions like human beings have emotions. We use these lashonos because it is the only way we can perceive it. The Christian distortion, again, I don't want to be marach on this too much, puts God just like you. And in a sense, therefore, I can connect him. Lahavdol even, well, not Lahavdol, I mean, paganism did even worse with, right? There, the gods weren't even righteous, right? The pagan gods did all, not only were they like superhuman humans, but, you know, they had divorces, and Jupiter got kicked out of the house and had to sleep outside, you know, all of these things, you know. But once again, there is an enormous emotional attraction in making God in your image.
But we do. We say the hands of God. And
right, but we say over and over again, that's just to give us some type of picture. But we keep on saying that that's just a picture, that's not a reality.
Is the root of all of this like a good, kind of a good place?
Say what? The root of?
The root of all this.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, no. What it's basically saying is, and right. So I'll go over this. So Bekitzer, do you see this point? The point here is that the Sheirish of Nadav and Aviyah came from an overwhelming sense of Devekus in Hashem, a desire to be connected to God, a passion, a burning passion that could not be contained even by rules and regulations, that wanted direct, unremediated connection to the Shekhinah. And as a result, the gevulim, the boundaries, the constraints, because mitzvahs, HaKadosh Baruch Hu basically says, you approach me in a certain way, a certain time, a certain place, a certain procedure, not anything you want to do. But it wasn't shayach for them. And as a result, their neshama left their guf because they had no shaychus to the world of Eilam Hazeh. So it's called an Eish Zara because what it basically means is the passion was a genuine passion. But like a fire that goes out of control, it can deviate away from tzivoy and then it becomes destructive. Just like anything else, right? Fire is necessary to maintain the world. Without fire, the world is literally a cold place. We need fire, but we can't allow the fire to become uncontrollable, because then it destroys us, and our neshama can no longer live within the boundaries of Olam Hazeh. Now again, if you go back historically and you study the different issues the Vilna Gaon had with Hasidus, this to a large degree was exactly, it's no longer that case today so much, but to a large degree, Hasidus emphasized in its early years the inner emotional state of the human being in terms of Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem. And the Vilna Gaon, as important as these inner states are, the Vilna Gaon saw a certain danger that it would displace the meticulous need to pay attention to Halacha. And in fact, now, the Vilna Gaon was fairly strong in this. The Vilna Gaon actually issued excommunications on Hasidus. And the early Hasidic movements, they actually sent the Baal HaTanya, Rav Shneur Zalman, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, he was never in Lubavitch, but the first Chabad Rebbe, Rav Shneur Zalman of Lyonja, to talk to the Vilna Gaon. And why did they pick Rav Shneur Zalman? Because of all of the early Gedolei Hasidus, he was the one who was most rooted in Halacha. In fact, he actually wrote the Rav Shulchan Aruch, he was very rooted in halachic detail, so they figured he would be the closest to the Vilna Gaon's temperament. In fact, he was the most litvisha chassid you could find, was the Baal HaTanya, and the Vilna Gaon refused to see him. Now, the Vilna Gaon's Talmud, Rav Chaim Volozhiner, took a very different approach. He did not sign any charamim against Hasidus, although there were some that other people were signing. But in his very famous sefer, Nefesh HaChaim, people don't realize this. The Nefesh HaChaim is actually part of a debate. Nefesh HaChaim doesn't always mention the svarim that he's challenging, but the Nefesh HaChaim is actually a debate against Hasidus by emphasizing the importance of Maisa HaMitzvah even over Kavana, and very specifically he is addressing what he regarded as the fallacy in the other side. So if you take it, in fact, very specifically, the sefer that he probably is responding to is the Tanya. So if you really want to understand Nefesh HaChaim and Tanya, learn the two svarim side by side. And neither one mentions the other one, but they are talking to each other, which is actually a very productive dialogue, because each of them were great, great gedolim, who had different shitos on different things. Although a lot of it they agreed. I mean, first of all, as they say, you know, I'm oversimplifying here, because this is complicated. Certainly, the Vilna Gaon and the Nefesh HaChaim strongly believed in the importance of Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem. They were not saying just do things mechanically. And on the other side of the coin, the Baal HaTanya certainly believed in the importance of doing mitzvahs properly. So you're not really dealing with a machlokas where one says A and one says B, and the one that says B rejects A, and the one that says A rejects B. That's certainly not the case. But it is a question, in fact, in all movements which are authentically within Judaism, it is never a question of this and not that, but it's a question of what aspects do you emphasize? What aspects are you madgish? What do you bring to the forefront? And in Ruchnius, there's a constant struggle, because as you bring certain ideas to the forefront, which are important, other ideas get weaker and recede, and therefore, like a pendulum, you got to push them forward. But ultimately, the MS is the integration of the two. And in fact, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Tzemach Tzedek, who was acknowledged also as a great gain in halacha, even among Misnagdim, actually writes that this is represented by the different role of the Kohen and the Levi in the Aveda. As Nadav and Avihu tragically learned, the role of the Kohen is not to improvise. The Kohen has to follow rules. Those of you, those husbands or whoever who have learned Daf Yomi, the order of Kachim, know that the labyrinth of rules regarding Korbanos literally have no end. You got to follow the procedures exactly. You want to do something extra, you want to wear a nice blue scarf to honor the Avodah Space of Mikdash, extra garment. Puzzle. So the Kohen represents consistency. The Kohen represents following the halacha with exactness, precision, no deviation. The Levim were the musicians and the singers in the Beis HaMikdash. And as you would expect, even though Chazal tell us there was a Shir Shal Yom, but that came later. In other words, if you go back to what did the Torah require Levim to do? It could be their original composition, their music, their singing. There are no halachos per se regarding this. This represents the creative, improvisational, emotional expression of Avodas Hashem. The Kohen represents the halacha. The Levi represents the emotion and the spontaneity and the creativity. The Tzemach Tzedek says, we see that in the Beis HaMikdash, the Aveda Shlema, the complete service, requires both Kohanim and Levim. So let's apply it to ourselves. Each of us builds a Beis HaMikdash in our heart. Bilvavi Mishkon Evnech. We have to incorporate within our personalities the aspect of the Kohen and the aspect of the Levi. The Kohen, got to follow halachas. Actually, women don't have Zman Kriyashma as a problem, but whatever it would be, whatever the halacha says, you got to follow. The fact that you'll feel more spiritual, I think I mentioned before Pesach, Rav Chaim Voloshin actually gives the example, what if somebody decides to make a better Pesach Seder, Pesach morning? He says, I'm going to go to sleep early, I'll wake up refreshed, Gevaldike Seder. Well, it's not going to be any, you know, Hashem says this is when you do it. Actually, I mentioned this mashal to a non-religious audience once, and a woman said, yeah, we couldn't get the family for the Seder, so we made it a week after Pesach. It was great, because they had to go to the in-laws. We made our Seder a week after Pesach. Well, that's wonderful, but you know. I guess there's some mitzvah in benching. I guess they benched. That's good. But, you know, unfortunately, most of the brachas would be brachas levatzalah at that point. And, well, there is a mitzvah every day to mention the Exodus, so maybe they have that, you know. But that's the point. But that's kind of the absurdity in which instead of looking at mitzvos as the commandments of Hashem and the way you serve Hashem, you look at them as things that make me feel good. Empowered is a word that's often used. Tools of empowerment. So that's the avodah of the Kohen. Follow the rules. We are avdei Hashem. But there is a risk sometimes, as the Hasidim say, where my fear of the Shkia is greater than my fear and my love of Hashem. Where things become sterile and mechanical, and even a certain dimension of obsessive compulsive, which can exist. In which I'm so focused on the tree, or not even the tree, or the leaf of the tree, that I don't see the forest, I don't see the picture, I don't see the goal, I don't see how this is connecting me to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's where the role of the Levi comes in which you have to get your emotions attuned to the greater idea of Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem. So the Tzemach Tzedek actually is actually telling us that the ideal personality combines the Chassid and the Misnaget, so to speak, to take both of those in and integrate them into a framework. Nadav and Aviyu emphasized the passion, and their neshama left their guf, because within the confines of the guf, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us the mitzvos maisios to direct us. Right, so this is, I'm sorry. So the reason, going back to the very first thing I said, so the reason why the Avaida of Yom Kippur is given after the deaths of Nadav and Aviyu is because look at the very first verse. Nadav and Aviyu died because they wanted a relationship with Hashem that didn't have boundaries or restrictions. Hashem says, Al yavo b'chol eis el ha-kodesh. Don't think, as a finite human being, you have unlimited access to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's a symbolic statement. Bezos, only following procedures, do you come to Hashem. Then it goes down and talks about Yom Kippur. But again, the importance of boundaries, the importance of limits. In fact, the Chidushi Harim says, again, it's an interesting coming from a Hasidus of thought, he says, you know, l'chaira like this, all of the nations of the world, Hashem offered the Torah to all of the nations of the world. And he then gave them one mitzvah that was so hard for them that they turned it down. So Yishmael was told, don't steal. Says, we can't do that. Esav was told, don't kill. We can't do that. So l'chaira, HaKadosh Baruch Hu kind of stacked the deck because HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave them a real hard one. And then they said no. How come he didn't do that to the Jewish people? Now the emes is the kasha is not such a strong kasha because the Jewish people didn't ask. I mean they said nasa v'nishma. The goyim asked, right? So Hashem gave them. The Jewish people didn't ask. But the Chidush HaYom says a different word. He says Hashem did give them a mitzvah that for a Jew is the hardest mitzvah to do. Well, listen. He said, keep away from Har Sinai for 3 days. You're going to see the Shekhinah on the mountain? Don't approach it. For a Jew to be told, don't come near to Hashem. That's the hardest thing for the Jewish neshama. But sometimes, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Al yavo b'chol eis el HaKodesh. In fact, Rav Soloveitchik used to say, and it's an interesting thing, he says, if the Eibishter didn't give us permission to daven to him and tell us he wants us to daven to him, Misvara, we wouldn't be allowed to daven to him. He says, how dare you think you can come to the Melech Malchei Amlachim and tell him what you want? What chutzpah? What arrogance? In other words, you need rishus. You need permission. Now, of course, Hashem desires it. Hashem gave us that permission. But he's making the point, without permission, God is not our buddy that we just come over and just tell him what we want. He says, tefillah itself, in fact, it's very interesting that, you know, on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, When the chazan begins Chazaras HaShatz, you'll notice there's a prayer that he recites. Yeah. The technical name for that prayer is Rishus. Mm-hmm. That's what it's called. He is asking Hashem's permission to approach the Kisei HaKavod. And really, every tefillah is asking Hashem for permission. This is why you take three steps back, as if you're about to enter Hashem's presence. You have to leave the room, so to speak, and then ask Hashem for permission to come forward, right? And that's hard for a Jew, because a Jew is so naturally davuk in Hashem. Now, just quickly on the Haftarah, I just want to show you one point. The Haftarah is a short Haftarah. It is the end of the book of Amos. Amos is one of the Treyasher, one of the 12 Chas Hashalom. They call them minor prophets. That's a totally, totally erroneous title. They were all major prophets, but smaller prophets in the sense that the books themselves are smaller, and therefore they were united in a single book called Treyasher, which in Aramaic is 12. Say again? You know, each Navi wrote his own, but in the time of Chazal, the time of Ezra, they joined them together in scrolls. No, each Navi wrote his own. Amos wrote Treyasher. Amos wrote the book of Amos. Now, Amos, the Rambam has an interesting thing about Amos. The Rambam writes that Nevuah was not a function only of tzidkus and midos, which of course it was, but Nevuah also required talent and training. The Rambam says you have to go to Navi school. Yeah. These are the B'nai HaNeviim. You learned techniques of meditation, focused thought. Now that doesn't mean every graduate became a Navi, but if you were tzaddik and roi lechach, you still needed training and techniques. The Abarbanel is cholek on the Rambam. And the Abarbanel actually says, Nevuah is a gift that God gives to the righteous, and even if you're totally unprepared for Nevuah, you can get it. And the two proofs the Abarbanel uses is one is Yonah, who did not want to be a Navi, and he got zapped by it. And the other is Amos, because Amos is described as a humble shepherd from Tekoa. And Amos basically says, I would tend sycamore trees, shkamim, and I was a roeh. Unlike Yeshayahu, for example, who was related to the royal house, Yeshayahu was an aristocrat. In fact, even linguistically, if you study the language of Tanakh, you will see that Yeshayahu uses very, very aristocratic, fancy language. Amos is what we would call a plain speaker. Amos was not trained to be a Navi, but because of his righteousness and saintliness, he was zoche to the gift of Nevuah. This is the Abarbanel who's cholek on the Rambam in the Moru Nevuchim. It is something to pay attention to. We don't, even in our schools, beishakos, whatever, well, yeshivas don't learn Nach anyway, but even in the places where they learn Nach, we often don't pay attention to the different uses of Lashon HaKodesh, of the different Nevi'im. Because I want to point out that one has to understand that every Navi communicates his Nevuah in his own signon, meaning, unlike the Torah, where Hashem told Moshe exactly what words to write down, a Navi is given a vision from Hashem, but he puts it in his own words. The actual words of the Navi, the word for word for word, is the Navi expressing the Nevuah Hashem gave him, and that is the meaning of the statement, Ein Shnei Nevi'im Misnagnim B'Signon Echad, that two Nevi'im may be given the same Nevuah, but they will express it in different ways based on their personality. Now, Amos lived before the exile of the 10 tribes, and therefore Amos' Nevuahs are both about the evils of Malchus Ephraim and also Malchus Yehuda. But the end of Amos is a very, very comforting prophecy. And I'll just read you the end. This is, again, the Haftarah following Acharei Mos. Just with time is almost out, I just want to share with you one pasuk here. Actually, in this one they reverse Acharei Mos and Kedoshim. Okay, whatever it is, this is Amos Perek Tes, and it says, well, first of all, we have the pasuk Harak Bayomahu, on that day, Okim Esukas David Hanayfalas, I will restore the fallen sukkah of David. And this is why we say on Sukkot and benching, Arachaman, who yokim lanu, es sukas David hanofalas. And Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch points out that it's very significant that the final war against Am Yisrael is described as the wars of Gog and Magog. And Gog and Magog are connected to the word for roof, Gag. So the Umos HaOlam that tried to destroy us live under a Gag, but David HaMelech Mashiach lives under a Sukkah. And the difference is, a Sukkah, you see the stars under your roof. You know that your existence on this earth is fragile. You recognize your vulnerability, your precariousness, your weakness, and your eyes look to the Ribono Shel Olam for Yeshua. This was the characteristic of Malchus Beis David. The Umos HaOlam who live with arrogance, with chutzpah, thinking that they are in control of the world, are a god because they build a solid roof to block out godliness. And it is the essence of Am Yisrael, if Hirsch says, that we live in this world under the sukkah, the whole year, not just on Sukkot. Now then it goes on, and it says, Hine yamim boyim, Amos concludes his sefer, behold, days are coming, the nigash choresh bakotzir, the plower shall reach to the harvester, the derech anovim, he who is pressing the grapes, b'moshe chazara, with he who is planting. Now again, the simple meaning of this pasuk is that God is going to bless Eretz Yisrael with such fertility that people will still be harvesting throughout the summer when it's time to plow for the new season. And people will still be pressing wine grapes when it's time to plant. In other words, it's describing a fertility in which the harvest will go all the way to the plowing season, as opposed to having months in between where the land is fallow. But there's a beautiful medrash that says that this is also a remez to an event that happened in the Chumash and that will happen, Liyasid Lavo, and that is the reunification of Yosef and Yehuda. Yosef is called the Kotzer, the harvester. Oh, we'll see why in a moment. Yehuda is called the plower. The Nigash Choresh Bakotzer, the plower and the harvester getting reunited, is what happened when Vayigash Elav Yehuda went to Yosef to plead. And that will also be the reunification of Mashiach ben Yosef, Mashiach ben David, and really the unification of the 10 tribes who were under, right? The 10 tribes were ruled by Shevet Ephraim. And it's the unification of Yosef and Yehuda, because you have to understand that as far as the prophets were concerned, the division of Am Yisrael into two separate kingdoms was a great tragedy. And the ultimate vision is the unification of Yosef and Yehuda. But why is Yosef called the harvester, the kotzer, and Yehuda called the choresh? So the Avni Nezer says the following idea, using the paradigms of Shabbos. The definition of the malacha of harvesting is oker davar migidulo. You uproot something from where it's growing. Yosef, right, we're creatures of the dirt. We were made from the dirt. We have Yetzer Haras. When Yosef is confronted with temptation, Yosef simply uproots himself from the temptation. Yosef simply says no. Yosef represents the kotzer, the one who harvests himself from chumrius, from dirt, from gashmius, from chait, from yetzer hara. Yosef is the kotzer. Yehuda represents a different form of aveda. Mm-hmm. When Yehuda is subject to temptation, Yehuda is nichshal, just as David HaMelech was nichshal, just as Bayaz, to some degree, did something that initially seemed not totally proper. But choresh is when you take the dirt and you soften it and you make it receptive for growth. That represents the koach of tshuva, where I take even my negative side and I refine it, I soften it, and I bring it back to Hashem. Yosef represents the idea of the tzaddik, who does not sin. Yehuda represents the idea of the person who fails, but then softens his heart, choresh, to soften the dirt, and come back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And Amos' Nevuah is that all of these different types of Jews will come together. There will be the tzaddikim, who will be our inspiration. But that even the Jews who have succumbed to nisayon, to failure, to chait, the choresh, they will soften their hearts and come back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that is Amos' vision. Now, the reason why I connect it to that, to the Parsha, the connection is not so apparent, actually. In fact, neither Haftarah seems to be connected to neither Parsha. It's kind of, and maybe that's why there's so much, maybe that's so much uncertainty about which Haftarah do you read, because no Haftarah has any obvious connection to the Parsha. But it could once again be that Nadav and Avihu represented the idea of totally uprooting themselves from the earth. And Amos says, no, it's important that the Kotzer be united with the Choresh, to understand that we are earthly. We have passions, we have taivas, we have averus, but we can take our physicality and we can elevate it to Hashem. And that's our ultimate avaida, and that is what will bring us to a geula shleimah.